Hello and welcome to the Around the Nation podcast for the week of Monday, November 1st, 2010. I'm Pat Coleman.
And I'm Keith McMillan.
And the Selection Sunday is getting closer. The field of 32 playoff teams is beginning to form. Well, we've got two teams in anyway, and 21 automatic bids left to be handed out, three Pool B and six at-larges. And one of the things we learned this week is about the same time we've learned it each of the past couple years, Keith, is once again, basically the East region implodes, and it looks like we are going to once again have a year without a number one seed from an East team.
Yeah, and it's certainly to the point where everybody is assuming that the playoff bracket, the easternmost playoff bracket, will have Mount Union be its number one seed. And while it's not really necessarily a given that Mount Union will even finish undefeated in this season, and they weren't ranked number one in their in the first set of regional rankings that came out, it is a pretty safe bet. And with Cortland coming back and scoring 10 points in the fourth quarter on Saturday to beat Montclair, which led pretty much the whole second half 9-0, and that Montclair State was the last team from a strong Eastern Conference that had a chance at finishing undefeated, being that number one seed, and then spreading the number one seeds. No pun intended, around the rest of the country. So what that does, I guess, is if you're a fan, of St. Thomas or North Central or Wheaton or one of these other teams that Mary Hardin Baylor may be in the mix. Wesley, hung on Saturday, and they're still undefeated. So all those teams are now right in that number one mix. And if you push Mountain Union, in theory, you push them to the Eastern bracket. There are other teams now that will they'll have a chance to host in the playoffs.
Keith, we've made a lot of discussion over the past 11 and a half months or so about how the NCAA selection committee more or less disrespected strength of schedule when it selected the at-large teams, especially at the end of the selection process last season. But one of the things I noticed was that SUNY Maritime, for example, they're undefeated. Their strength of schedule isn't the worst in the country. The strength of schedule, which is the worst in the country right now this week, is Wittenberg. SUNY Maritime, they had an opportunity certainly to push them a little bit higher in the poll. They had instead four teams with one regional loss ahead of them, and even now with Montclair State having picked up its first regional loss, they may well still be ahead of SUNY Maritime as well. And for people who are asking, no, I would have to say there's no opportunity for SUNY Maritime to get a number one seed here.
Yep, Pat, I tend to agree with you there. And for all the hard time that people do give to the committee, it's kind of like being an offensive lineman or a referee. Nobody notices until you mess something up. It's one of those situations being on the selection committee, and they really did the right thing, I think, in almost everybody's opinion, except for maybe the folks over in Throgs Neck, in not ranking in SUNY Maritime higher because they don't play in the strongest conference. They're some of their out of conference teams that they've played this year, Western Connecticut State being one of them. They have had a really rough year in the NJAC. At the time we thought that was a little bit of a significant win. And it really hasn't helped their strength of schedule number at all. And the reason we want to see, there's several reasons that we want to see those strength of schedule numbers respected. But the main reason really is because if you get in a situation where teams are only being looked at because of their record, their flat record, whether they have zero losses, one loss, or two loss. And I'm guilty of doing that a lot when I'm breaking teams down sometimes in Around the Nation, but you take that strength. You have to take that strength of schedule into account, because if you don't, really, what's going to start to happen, and it started to happen a little bit already, is teams are just going to schedule the easiest teams they can find, or the shortest road trips, or the cheapest road trips. And as fans, we'll and as observers around the country, and as people who want to see the 32 strongest possible teams in the field, following the automatic bid formula, we'll lose out on those games that we love so much in September. And then, some of them will still be played because of necessity, in Texas and in Pacific Northwest and maybe Wisconsin. But for around the country, we need to see those. We enjoy seeing those games. And we're really standing at risk of losing out on them, because right now it's become a situation, and this is something that some people would say that it's the committee's job to reward these teams to set that agenda for the coming year, for the next few years. That if you reward the teams that play the stronger schedules, even if they happen to have a regional loss or two regional losses, if you reward them with higher seeds or with the at-large playoff spots, you'll get that stronger scheduling going forward. You'll get a more representative playoff bracket, and you'll get a more exciting playoffs. You know, Pat, we've had seasons where the first two rounds have had, you know, hardly any good games, and then we've had other seasons where it's been a real good, tight bracket, and it's, you know, you have six or eight finishes in the first round of those 16 games where they came down to the fourth quarter or separated by one score. So, you know, as fans, observers, players, coaches, coaches pull their hair out, but the rest of us enjoy those close games, and we want to see the best possible playoff bracket that can possibly be put together.
That 90 minutes between about 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern and 3:30 p.m. Eastern, perhaps the best 90 minutes of Division III football of the season, that first week, that first weekend of the playoffs. We talked about briefly about Mount Union.
When you said 90 minutes, I thought you meant my comment.
or almost one of our podcasts at this rate. We talked about Mount Union being number 3 in the North Region regional rankings. The two teams that are ahead of them, Wheaton and North Central, they play each other this week. You presume one of them is going to drop. Mount Union at the very worst this next week would end up number 2, and Mount Union, of course, is going to get a nice little boost in its strength of schedule as well. The winner of the Wheaton North Central game will pick up a win against a regionally ranked opponent, and so will Mount Union if it beats Baldwin Wallace. So that'll be a bit of a wash. Both teams are going to improve in the strength of schedule, and you know, honestly, Keith, I'm not sure it necessarily even matters per se whether Mount Union is ranked as the first team in the North Region or the second team in the North Region, if we're kind of assuming that one of them is going to get pulled out. The only way that might come back to be reconsidered is in the national semifinals, when they come to determine who gets the home field if that CCIW winner and Mount Union both advance that far.
Yeah, you're right, but it would, Pat, matter to a team like St. Thomas or a team like Mary Hardin-Baylor, who sees itself in that mix for the other number one seeds, to see the CCIW champion be the first team on the board from the North. And that's certainly possible given the way CCIW teams performed in that out-of-conference schedule this year. I believe it was 22-2, something to that effect. You know, that's going to affect the OOWP of whatever team wins the championship. So it's going to affect the strength of schedule numbers. You know, maybe this is a year where we see a North team ranked higher than Mount Union, even if Mount Union ends up being that number one seed in the easternmost bracket. And Pat, if that happens to be the champion of its bracket, it would be really interesting, at least a departure from previous years, to see that semifinal round, that you know, December 4, December 11th, those games not be at Alliance.
And it would be the first time in the expanded playoff era, or in the automatic bid era, that Mount Union had to go on the road to play a playoff game. The one year in which Mount Union lost a regular season game, 2005 to Ohio Northern, Mount Union was not the top seed in the North and would have had to travel in the national semifinals if the top seed in the East that year was Delaware Valley, or a higher seed in the East had advanced. Instead, Rowan beat Delaware Valley. Rowan, lower seeded. You remember when we used to get seeds on the bracket, right? They had to go to Mount Union, and Mount Union's streak of home games continues. Looking at the strength of schedule numbers too, Keith, for Mount Union, strength of schedule is just 496, but that's usually, you know, that's not unusual considering the size of the Ohio Athletic Conference. It hasn't really kept the committee from making Mount Union a number one seed before.
No, it hasn't, and sometimes the criteria does provide some limitations, and one of them is if you depend a lot on that strength of schedule number, and then you get a team that plays 9 games against conference opponents, those are going to even out over the course of the season. That number is going to be right at 500. And so it's really just going to be whether they have the one out of conference game is going to determine their OWP, and then the OWP, you know, tends to not get too far from the middle there too. So yeah, that you know, I talked to some people from the committee this week. Did a little bit of the legwork for writing a column about this issue that's so important to people in the East. And when we get to talking about the playoffs, and one of the things they said is, you know, football is so unlike basketball or baseball in the selection committee, where you have 25 or 30 games worth of data to pour over. In football, you have the 10, sometimes some cases 9. In some cases, you know, teams only have 7 regional games that are really being considered. You know, Co is one of those teams this year that had to play a couple of NAIA teams, and now they're not going to have the same 10 opponents, you know, to look at. That's just less data for the committee to pour over when they're trying to decide whether this is a worthy team to bring into the playoffs. And so what they say, and this is, I believe this is on the record, is that sometimes you have to use a little bit of subjectivity, and that's something that we wanted sort of out of the old system, because it was so subjective when it was the 16 teams and it was the four regional rankings, and they would put out the top 6 and only the top 4 would make it. And it basically at that point sort of seemed like if you were the team that had been there last year, you know, you could just stay there, and it would, you know, it would be, say, in the South, it was, you know, Lycoming, Trinity, Western Maryland, Catholic, and if all those teams were undefeated, you didn't have a chance really to leapfrog those teams. And so, you know, you took the subjectivity out when the playoff spots were added. But at some point, I think the fans appreciate it, and I think the committee does use a little bit of common sense. And one of those things is if Mount Union is the number one team in the country, and our top 25 poll, the coaches poll, those two polls are not they're not supposed to be part of the selection committee criteria. But if a team is a strong number one in the country, it would be very silly for them to not be a number one seed. This year, you know, that's not necessarily the case. Mount Union's not number one in the country. And if the numbers bear out that the CCIW champion, who may be, you know, number 4 or 5 at that point, I guess more likely they'll be the highest, they'll be as 5. But that, you know, that's okay to have the fifth ranked team to be a number one seed, even if it's over number 2 in the end. As we mentioned earlier, Pat, we're probably safe to assume that Mount Union will get one of the ones if they finish undefeated.
Yeah, it's not like having the number 14 team in the country, for example, being the number one seed. So we had the East kind of self-destruct a little bit, or at least the top team in the East, the last great hope, Montclair State, losing to Cortland State. You know, Pool B, Keith, we had, of course, the one big Pool B face-off between Wesley and Salisbury, and then Case Western Reserve, who, you know, I have to take some credit, right, for mentioning this as a possibility in the triple take, but you know, University of Chicago playing pretty well this year, playing at home, and Case Western Reserve saw its 38 game regular season winning streak end, and now all of a sudden they're not unbeaten, and you know, who knows what Pool B looks like now for them.
Yeah, I think you absolutely, now they go from being a lock and a team that a lot of people, or at least a lot of us who follow it closely and post about it on the post patterns board, sort of assuming that Wesley's going to finish undefeated. You assume Case Western Reserve is going to finish undefeated, and you assume SUNY Maritime is going to finish undefeated, and that any undefeated team in Pool B was pretty much automatic. Now, as we learned this past Saturday, none of those things were really automatic. Wesley trailed Salisbury and ended up winning that game 17-14. You know, Case, Western Reserve, as you mentioned, lost. And SUNY Maritime was in that big battle with Norwich. And so Pool B was seriously in flux on Saturday.
And, of course, you know, I would say Case Western Reserve not out of the woods yet. Of course, they still have to play. They play at home against WashU and Carnegie Mellon. Carnegie Mellon, you know, is only 4-4 on the season, but they gave Wittenberg a great game. And WashU, of course, is the team that beat Wabash earlier in the season. Chicago at 6-2, WashU at 6-2. You have to think theoretically either one of those teams could play their way into the playoffs if they beat Case and win their other regular season remaining game as well.
Yeah, I think there's the loss by Case Western Reserve here opens up the door to a lot of those fringe Pool B teams who, you know, you make a list of the teams in Pool B and you're just keeping the 1 and 2 loss teams on there just in case this happens, and then it does happen. You know, 3 of those spots are definitely going to go to Pool B teams, no matter what happens here in the next couple weeks. And even if, you know, Case picks up another loss or SUNY Maritime were to lose somehow, or, you know, there's still going to be 3 teams getting in, and there's some other teams that feel they need to be in this discussion. They would like to be in this discussion. And, you know, I mean, how do you go, for instance, Salisbury? You lose by 3 points to Wesley, which is ranked 3rd in our latest poll, and then lose by 4 to Hampton Sydney, which is also ranked in the poll and is unbeaten. That's, you feel like you're right on the same level with some of the stronger teams in the country, and yet right now they're not a playoff, you know, they're not in great shape for the playoffs, but it could happen.
Salisbury with a 6-0-1 strength of schedule with their 6 regional games. They were 7th in the South Region rankings coming in to the week. You figure they're still going to be in, I would have to say. They'd probably still be ahead of Washington and Jefferson, and Salisbury ends up number 9. So Salisbury, you know, not out of it with 2 regional losses. You know, SUNY Maritime finishes off its season by playing at Gallaudet on Saturday. And then they are in the clubhouse. If they're 9-1, they have to be really sweating the final week. If they're 10-0, they should definitely keep practicing because they will be playing somewhere in Week 12, whether it's a NCAA playoff game or if somehow they don't get selected an ECAC postseason game, which they have on the East Coast. Going farther down the list, I mean, we touched on the UAA teams, and I talked to Greenville head coach Ordell Walker after their game on Friday, they beat Crown to win the Upper Midwest Athletic Conference, and the UMAC does not have an automatic bid next year. It starts next year, and I asked Coach Walker for his reaction to having a conference championship but not having an automatic bid going along with it.
You know, not really. I mean, you just play the hand that's dealt. And so I remember when I first got here, it was 1-9, 3-7, 3-7. So, you know, I'm happy to be in this position.
You know, Pat, that's an interesting take to be happy that to be 7-3 because, you know, what you're seeing with a lot of these conferences who have been, I guess, not our strongest conferences in Division III, they've either been down or they're just getting put together. You know, in the case of the ECFC, they don't have that history and tradition, and not just the conference doesn't have it, but the schools are so new that they don't have it, and the playoffs are new to a lot of these teams. These are teams that are going to be getting Pool A bids soon, automatic bids, and you want to see that competitiveness. You want to see that level rise up. You know, if you look at Greenville's schedule, played Augustana out of the CCIW, lost 28-7 in the opener. But you know, that's a score that's not so far away from that they weren't competitive. You know, competitive against Milliken, another CCIW school, and lost also at Albion, and beat Anderson from the Heartland. So, you know, Greenville playing a decent schedule with its 4 non-conference games before it got into the UMAC, which so far it's run the table in the UMAC, and I think that's what you want to see with these teams who are going to be earning playoff spots next season. And you know, I just real quickly go to Saturday, and I'm watching Wisconsin Stevens Point giving the number 1 team in the country quite a game, and you look at the size and strength of those players, and then realize, you know, they've lost to Willamette and to Whitewater, and they're a 2 loss team in that Pool C discussion, you know, right now, where they basically have hardly any chance at all to make the playoffs, and yet you know there are teams like that. There are 2 lost teams from these real strong conferences, and 3 lost teams probably that would beat up on some of the teams who are going to be getting into the playoffs.
I know that with the automatic bid coming to the UMAC next year, the UMAC has, I think, as a conference office, if I'm not mistaken, has really tried to stress to its football coaches to schedule like you're preparing to go to the playoffs, and Greenville certainly did that this year. Next year, conference teams will only have 1 non-conference game because the conference adds another team, as Presentation out of Aberdeen, South Dakota, which is in the conference for all sports, adds football in 2011. And we'll talk more about that later this week, not in this podcast, but I talked with Andy Carr, the upcoming presentation head coach. Keith, you touched on the Whitewater-Stevens Point game. Tell us a little bit more about A, Whitewater-Stevens Point, and B, your whole trip this weekend.
You know, starting at the top, it had been the last time I'd been to Whitewater, believe it or not. The field was grass. It didn't have a turf field. And they hadn't won the championship yet. I went there and I saw them, and I remember being really impressed and saying, you know, this is a team that has a chance to make the playoffs and make some noise, you know, when they get there. I was looking at them and saying, I don't see any reason why they couldn't beat Linfield, which at the time was the team, and you know, along with Mountain Union, of course. And you know, that's what ended up happening that season. But that's how long it had been since I've been to Whitewater. So now this is a program and a stadium in Perkins Stadium, which, you know, still looks similar in some ways, but it has a huge championship banner saying, not respect the tradition, powered by tradition, it says. And it's all across sort of the field house on the back. They redid the visitor side since I'd last been there. And just a really great atmosphere to see a game. I don't think it's my favorite place to see a game. You know, it's hard to beat places like St. John's or, you know, Ithaca, somewhere that has a natural feature. Coast Guard has that natural feature to be right on the water. And certain places, you know, even where I play, where you know, you get these small stadiums where it's like, you know, like Hampton Sydney, who has for fans to sit on the grass, and certain small schools don't have that track around the field, so the fans get right up on the field. Perkins Stadium is not like that at all. Perkins is more like Cortland State or some of these other real beautiful facilities, and you can't say there's any facilities in Division III that are just, you know, far and away better. But I thought what really stood out about the Whitewater atmosphere, and it was homecoming, so that played into it a little bit, was their toughest conference opponent to date. I'm sure that played into it a little bit too, but really spirited crowd. You know, I don't think I've ever seen any of the places I've been, maybe St. John's, but where the whole entire place is dressed in that team color. You know, and there are, you know, a couple dots in the crowd wearing the Wisconsin Badgers stuff, the red stuff, and they really stood out, you know, because everybody has the purple and the black and the white on, and the different, you know, not homemade T-shirts, but, you know, unique slogans, really unique just to Whitewater, and you know, the Pound the Rock shirts, and there's band and the cheerleaders and all the stuff that, you know, most schools have. But when you bring it all together and you mix it into this pot where you have a stadium with a video board and you have 11,448 people there, you have a good opponent giving them a pretty decent game, and it's just a great place to see a game. It's a lot of fun, and I imagine part of it comes from winning that national championship. You know, people want to be associated with a winner. They want to come see a winner play, but part of it too is that administration, they're taking that and running with it and making that game day experience be as fun as possible. You know, I can't tell you how many places I've been to in Division III, Pat. You know, we talked a couple podcasts ago about that contest you saw at William Patterson where they did that at halftime. And they had a rock, paper, scissors contest, which was something we'd never seen before and we talked about, which was because it was kind of neat. You know, at Whitewater, they're doing something between every quarter, bringing fans out onto the field and, you know, doing the running around the bats and falling down or you know, trying to win prizes and do it. But that's the kind of thing that, you know, you and I, as say, like, we're the dads in the family, we're the diehard football fans, or we're the ones that are alma maters of D3 schools. But then you have the wife and the kids who aren't, don't have that same interest. But if you want to bring them all to the game and let them have a good time, and also too, you get the kids interested in the sport before, you know, that's how you fall in love with something. You go with your dad or your parents and you fall in love with it. You know, to make that whole game day experience something that the whole family can enjoy is really cool. And I didn't mean to get off on a whole tangent about that, but I, you know, sometimes you spend time somewhere and you get to thinking, this is something that some D3 diehards will never get to see. And while they may have a place that they go every Saturday and they love that place, and they may go around the conference and see a few different places, you may never get a chance to go out to Whitewater and set foot out there like I did on Saturday. And so sometimes I feel that's part of the responsibility, is to bring that back to everyone and share that experience. Game-wise for Whitewater, Really, those guys, they probably don't feel like they're operating very sharp at this point. But I thought up front, you know, blocking-wise, Lavelle Coppedge had 38 carries, 187 yards, and it was one of those games where it didn't seem like he had 38 carries. You know, you see the stat sheet, and you go, wow, he carried it 38 times? And you know, because they were just sort of methodically doing it, just chipping away, hanging onto the ball. And, you know, Steven's point, probably as talented as anybody that we'll see, you know, at least in the first couple of rounds of the playoffs. I mean, this is a team that could, you know, could hang with other playoff level teams. And again, you know, they had that early game in the season where they led Willamette 14-0 and end up losing 33-14. And part of what happened to them on Saturday too, and this is maybe the story of their season this year, is they have the talent, but they aren't sharp. They make some crucial mistakes, and that hurt them. You know, they were going in, score 7-0 late in the first half, and threw a touchdown pass to the tight end. There was a holding penalty, so they got it pulled out. 3rd and 20, incomplete pass. Kicked had a 40-yard field goal attempt and missed it. Whitewater drives a little bit, punts, and downs them, you know, around the 10-yard line. Stevens Point, first snap, the quarterback, Jake Swank, fumbles the snap. Whitewater picks it up on the 5-yard line, scores in one play. So it goes from being a 7-7 game, potentially, going into the half, to 14-0 Whitewater. And when you're playing the number one team in the country, in front of this atmosphere where, you know, anything good happens, it just fires up the whole sideline. You can't let that kind of stuff happen to you. You can't make the simple mistakes. And they hurt themselves with that on Saturday, because I think talent-wise, you know, maybe not up front, but on either side of the ball, but everywhere else on the field, they matched up with the team that's the defending national champion. So, you know, that's interesting. A couple other interesting points from Whitewater is Coppedge had the 38 carries. Booker Stanley, who'd been bothered by a shoulder injury, did get in for a series in the second quarter. I think he had finished with only 3 carries. And Antoine Anderson, who has been, you know, the sort of the number two back, splitting the role with Coppedge. They don't, at Whitewater, they don't do a set rotation, really, where it's like Coppedge goes 2 series, then Anderson goes 1, or something like that. I mean, we've seen them do that in past years in the playoffs, but that doesn't seem like that's the case right now. And, you know, they just leaned on Coppedge as much as they could, and he hasn't been healthy for every game this season, and neither has Booker Stanley, so maybe they just wanted to get him as much work as they could get. And they knew they needed to, you know, to run the ball to finish Stevens Point off. And they eventually did that, by the way, 27-14, if you happen to not know that already. I'm sure we would have led the podcast off if they would have lost. But, you know, the running back situation is something to watch going forward, because Anderson, here's a guy who's had like a 240-yard game this season, and he had no carries, no touches on Saturday. You know, he played on special teams, and that just speaks to the depth right now that Whitewater has, and their offensive line is really they're great up front. You know, the Warhawks are in love with what Matt Blanchard is doing at quarterback. You know, he's not he's not the same as the quarterback they had last year, Jeff Donovan. He's not Jeff at all. You know, he's his own guy, and they're trying to, you know, play to his strengths, and you know, he's become a leader for them on offense. You can see it out there. You know, him taking command of the huddle, and it's interesting with other guys who are stars, you know, in Division III, you know, to see this quarterback who's still growing as a starter come into his own. So that's there's a lot of that going on. And Whitewater, man, defensively, they just get after it on that defensive line. You see them in the backfield all day, and that's going to be something that when a team gets Whitewater in the first round of the playoffs, you know, assuming of course they get in and all that. They're going to see something with that defensive front four that they maybe haven't seen all season, and it's going to be tough to block, and that's where the difference is going to be, you know, maybe for the first couple rounds in the playoffs. So I hate to go on a, you know, 5-minute spiel about it, but if we haven't had a chance to talk really a whole lot about Whitewater this year and these guys, you know, you went to see them earlier. These guys are the national champions. They are maybe as strong as some of either of the two championship teams have been. They're very aware that that any one bad game could derail it all, that they're not guaranteed to get back to Salem, or much less even the playoffs, that nobody hands the WIAC trophy or title to them at the beginning of the season. You know, they felt like Stevens Point was a legitimate threat, and Oshkosh would be a legitimate threat. And Oshkosh is a team that actually lost on Saturday. And, you know, they're speaking highly of Oshkosh and not knowing that necessarily. But in fact, that game hadn't even started by the time the Whitewater game was over. But they got the right mindset too. So I mean, it's good to devote a little bit of time to talking about them, because we will talk about them probably at some point down the line here. And it's going to be a fun playoff year, I think, because of the way, you know, Whitewater is. First of all, there's the camp of, all right, you know, we want to see Whitewater, we want to see Mountain Union again. And then there's the camp that wants to see anything but that. And, you know, they're looking at this Mountain Union, not struggling, but, you know, giving up points, having close games for a half or three quarters this year. And they're saying maybe this is the year where we can break in.
And that wasn't, of course, the only game you saw. And I don't apologize for going off, and I think it was more than 5 minutes, but I did ask you a fairly open-ended question, so I don't think it was off topic at all. And then afterwards, you know, you got a chance to take the trip that I think you and I have been talking about for 4 or 5 years now, where we combine a Whitewater and a Carthage, or a North Central and a Carthage. In this case, Carthage was the second game.
Yeah, and that, you know, for as nice as it was to get down there, and you know, watch them play under the lights at Art Keller Field. They're in the midst of a building project that's going to make their stadium look pretty cool. Well, I guess the stadium's going to stay the same, but they're building a you know, one of those rec centers behind it, and half of it's already built, and they're building more of it behind the stadium. And you can tell it's kind of part of the field is on a slope, and it's surrounded. It's a good atmosphere to see a game. Might be a better place to be during the day because Kenosha is right on Lake Michigan, and in Wisconsin on Saturday, man, it was warm at the Whitewater game, and I dressed in layers because I didn't want to bring a jacket on the plane, so I figured, you know, I'll wear 3 shirts and take one off. I was taking them off at Whitewater, and I was wishing I had more at Carthage. I mean, as soon as the sun went down, it was freezing. And so atmosphere-wise, it might have been better to be at Carthage during the day, but it wasn't their best game. You know, they came out, I think, pretty flat. I think they knew they were playing North Park, and some guys can get up for every game, and some guys can't. And I don't know what it was, but they got a, I wouldn't say a significant chewing out after the game, but they, you know, they said, hey, that was flat, you know, and you guys battled through it. You know, they were tied at 10 at the half with North Park. And for those of you who don't know, North Park is the sort of the doormat of the CCIW. There's no nice way to say it. They haven't won a conference game since beating Elmhurst in 2001. But they were competitive on Saturday night, and you know, they do things a little differently. First of all, that size wise, I mean, you can tell when you lay your eyes on a WIAC team or an NJAC team or a CCIW team. At least I can. You know, those are the biggest, strongest teams you'll see. And I purposely left out fastest because I think so. There are other conferences who recruit speed as well as anybody else. But you know, you just see guys that you don't see on Division III fields, you know, playing, you know, guys are playing safety and linebacker sometimes. That would be defensive ends and some other D3 teams. So, you know, Carthage fits that profile, big, strong CCIW team, and North Park doesn't really. You know, you can tell which team is the doormat out there. And then North Park, too, was a little strange where they got in a situation in the fourth quarter where they were trailing by 2 touchdowns, and they're moving the ball fine, running the ball. But I guess they don't feel real confident throwing the ball right now. They run well, and they're building the morale up in the program. You can see it on the sideline. The guys, you know, they're sort of smelling, we have a chance to win this game. We're in this game. And they're not in games necessarily in the fourth quarter all that often. And it was a 7-point game for a while. Carthage made it 23-10, and that's what it ended up being. But they got it to a point where just by running it, really not throwing it at all, getting it down inside the 5-yard line with about a couple minutes left, to a point where if they would have scored, it would have been a 6-point game against a top half CCIW team. Had a chance to break that streak going on 9-10 years here where they haven't won a conference game. And, you know, they would have been basically up to an onside kick and then them trying to run the ball for another score within the last 2 minutes. So it did get interesting. And trip-wise, I was a little foolish. I tried to stop and check out as many fields as I could on the way, and I ran into a high school game at Carroll, and then also there was a high school game going on at Wisconsin Lutheran's field, which is right off the highway going north of the city, and also saw Concordia, Wisconsin's campus in Mequon, but it was kind of silly of me to go up there because it was dark by the time I got there, so I really didn't get a good sense of it, and I missed a little bit of the beginning of the Carthage game because I tried to hit too many fields on the way. But Pat, you know, you and I, we don't get to travel every week, and even if we did, there's, you know, Division III football in 30 states, so, you know, it would take us, you know, two seasons to get to every state just once, and then you get there, and you know, but yeah, as we mentioned, if we can get those staggered kickoffs where there's a 1 o'clock game at Whitewater, and these were, I guess technically they were 6 o'clock kickoffs locally at Carthage and at Oshkosh, you know, it was sort of like my duty to go see another game because we don't get a chance to get out there as much as we'd like, and there's some you know, metropolitan areas or some areas with heavy concentration of D3 schools, and Wisconsin is one of them. They got the state schools and the private schools. You know, Illinois is another one in the Midwest, of course, Ohio, and then as you get east, you know, New York and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and Virginia have their handful of D3 schools too. So it was quite a trip. It was a long day, a lot of short drives, you know, an hour here, 45 minutes there, but it was fun.
Unfortunately, when I go to the Wabash-Wittenberg game on Saturday this upcoming week, there is not another game to match it up with, and I did do some significant searching and reconsidering if that was the trip I wanted to make. Also, this past week, of course, as we mentioned at the top of the broadcast, the second automatic bid was handed out. DePauw clinched the SCAC back in Week 8 last week. This past week, St. Thomas clinched the MIAC title. They defeated Gustavus Adolphus by the score of 43-6. And now, having seen St. Thomas for the third time this season, I was beginning to think in the middle of the week, wondering if I had just seen them so often that I was beginning to see their flaws and not really able to appreciate whether this team was good, whether it was going to be a national contender or not. You know, on Saturday, I'm not necessarily certain that I saw too much that would necessarily change that, if only because Gustavus didn't really have the chance to put up much of a fight against the Tommies. It was close early on and close at the half. St. Thomas struggled a little bit to move the ball in the first quarter into the with the wind at their back, actually, in a 20-25 mph wind most of the day. Gustavus did a nice job on their opening drive, chewing up half of the first quarter, although they were not able to come away with any points. They did score in the second quarter on a gadget play that went 50 yards for a touchdown, but it was pretty much all St. Thomas from that point, especially in the second half, as the Tommies went on to win 43-6. One of the things about this week, this past week, Week 8, it's one of the games that opposing playoff coaches are going to get on video. You're required to exchange your last three regular season games, and for St. Thomas, that number started already, and this is St. Thomas piled some things into this game. They showed an onside kick in the second quarter. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Running back Ben Wortman threw a touchdown pass to Fritz Wahlvogel on a gadget play. Wahlvogel threw a pass to Ricky Marguerite for 26 yards. So they got all that in there. A bunch of running backs played as the game wore down, and they got as the game got out of hand. So Ben Wortman was out in the third quarter after having carried just 18 times for 81 yards. Colin Tobin carried for 81 yards himself in a backup role with 10 carries. And I talked to Glenn Caruso after the game, and because of the wind, the audio is not worth presenting to you. But what I basically to set it up, what I asked him was, they performed the onside kick in the second quarter, and that was the quarter in which Gustavus was to have the wind at their back. St. Thomas scored and then onside kicked right away. I thought ostensibly thinking. Coach Caruso was playing the smart move to keep the ball out of Gustavus's hands in a quarter in which they had the wind at their back. And he told me while he'd love to take credit for that, couldn't really say that was part of the game plan. He just saw that they noted on film during the week that that Gustavus would be particularly vulnerable to an onside kick, and didn't really the quarter didn't really play into it. Then when Gustavus finally did get the ball back with the wind at their back, they went for it on fourth down and on fourth down from their own 35-yard line, just to try to make sure that they could maintain the ball for at least one possession in that quarter, and that's the one where they eventually did break through and get the long touchdown. But you know, I didn't come away feeling any better about St. Thomas, but then again, the previous week, having seen them against Bethel and only scoring 10 points, I had serious doubts. You know, I don't know if they don't belong in the top two. We know that nobody belongs in the top two, and I think maybe North Central is my number. Well, I mean, ballot wise, North Central is my number three, but I think they're in a little bit of separation they've earned from the teams behind them. That clump of, in my mind, it's Wesley, St. Thomas, and then Mary Hardin-Baylor after that.
Yeah, those are the top six teams on my ballot as well, although in a different order, and it's been that way all season for me. That those, I guess it didn't start out with those exact six, but it's been several weeks now with those exact six, and I've had the same top four with St. Thomas being in that group. So you do go from week to week, you check them out, and you know it's different when you get to see them, and I only get to analyze from afar. But it's always good to have that analysis. A couple of things that you mentioned that I thought are pretty interesting. There's a maybe two schools of thought on the playoff video idea, where you know the other team is gonna see what you get, and this is really only for coaches who are basically assuming they're in, which is not a very coach-like thing to do, because they're always freaking out about the next opponent and not looking two, three games down the road. But for those coaches who do think about things like that, you know, there's two ways to play it. One, you want to have those gadget plays on there and onside kicks to put as many ideas in the other coach's mind. Whatever coach is watching that film, watching that video, you know, you just want to freak them out and make them say, we got to be ready for everything. And if it makes them devote 10 minutes of time that they could be practicing, you know, to pick up your blitz, instead they're practicing to take onside kicks or, you know, defend some crazy trick play that you have, that, you know, that's a win for your team, because your team's preparing what it does for those same 10 minutes, you know. And the other school of thought is, especially if you don't have your strongest opponents backloaded at your schedule, or if you're in a situation where, like St. Thomas, where they've beaten the toughest team on their schedule already, you know, you could dial it back a little bit and just run your base stuff, so that whatever you have in your bag of tricks, none of the playoff teams that you'll see ever see that. And you know, a lot of coaches live in the moment, in the sense that they're just doing whatever's best for their team that particular Saturday, and they don't jump ahead. The other thing I thought was really interesting that came to me while you were talking, Pat, is this past week, actually week nine, and you know, the clinching usually starts around week eight, and we had DePaul clinch last week, and then usually a couple of teams are clinched by now, you know, more than two. I guess we have a couple, and usually a three or four or five, you know, clinch this week, and then a wave of them will clinch in week 10, and then there's those last showdown games in week 11, and that's usually down to a handful, you know, less than 10, you know, sometimes more than two or three. It seems like we're in this position where we had one clinch in week 8, one clinch in week 9, where there's going to be a wave of teams here in week 10, this coming Saturday, the first weekend in November. There's just going to be a wave of clinchings this week, and then it'll boil it down to just a few games in week 11 where we're watching closely to see who how these title races shake out.
Well, and we do have the opportunity. I've pulled out about 10 teams that can just flat out clinch with a win, and there are opportunities for other teams to clinch if they win and someone else loses, or if the right things break. But here's some of the, for example, just the prominent teams that could clinch coming up in week 10. with a W. The North Coast Conference comes down to a head-to-head game in Week 10. That's where I'm going to be, in Springfield, Ohio, where Wabash is at Wittenberg. Mary Hardin-Baylor could win the American Southwest Conference with a W. Linfield could finish off the Northwest Conference. Mount Union, they're facing Baldwin-Wallace, which is a team that has just one loss and is, you know, adjacent to them in the standings. They need to win that game. Thomas More could clinch against Waynesburg. Waynesburg has just one loss in the conference. They can't clinch on Saturday because Waynesburg, if I remember correctly, has one more conference game remaining, while Thomas More is playing cross river rival Mount St. Joseph in Week 11. St. Lawrence still, they had a bye this week, so we didn't have much else to talk to, about them, but they could clinch the Liberty League this week. Trine can clinch the MIAA upcoming. Delaware Valley can clinch the MAC. Whitewater can clinch the WISC. And St. Norbert could save everybody having to do a lot of tiebreaker calculations by winning the Midwest Conference. They have to beat Lake Forest, which is 2-7 overall, 2-6 in the league. And if they don't, there are five teams in line behind them in second place, one game behind, waiting to have their say.
Yeah, I mean, that's the craziest potential title scenario that maybe we've ever seen. And I remember looking at it at it this week, you know, before this week's games, before St. Norbert sort of rose to the top a little bit. And just, you know, shaking my head, because you don't know who's going to come out of that group. And there were teams at different points during the season that got a little bit of a lead and could have pulled away with that conference, and nobody did. And when it's a year where your perennial champions like St. Norbert and Monmouth take losses early, they're weakened a little bit, that's a time when Carroll and Ripon, and, you know, if Grinnell's coming out of nowhere and playing well this year, those are the chances for those teams to step up and become championship teams, become playoff teams. And, you know, if St. Norbert handles its business on Saturday, it'll be sort of more of the same from the MWC. But, you know, not for lack of making this season interesting. And that's certainly an interesting one. Pat, you mentioned the teams that could clinch with a win. There's also quite a few games, or just big games that you know, maybe they'll clinch on Saturday, and maybe it'll take one more week in Week 11. But this is we had one really great week earlier this season where there were something like 12 outstanding games on the schedule nationally, and you know, that's like an eighth of the games being played had major conference or title implications. You know, we're looking at a week not quite 12 great games, but certainly a big handful of them. And I guess that's pretty typical for Week 10. But Wheaton at North Central in the little brass bell game, two ranked teams, two undefeated teams. It's going to have an effect on the Pool C picture, that, you know, because whoever loses that game is going to drop into that group and be a pretty strong Pool C contender. As we analyzed last week, one a little stronger than other if it loses. Wartburg at Central, we've been waiting to get the third piece of that IIAC puzzle. Coe and Central play really early, and then Wartburg and Coe played a couple weeks later, and now Wartburg goes to Central on Saturday. Pat, you mentioned Wabash at Wittenberg in the North Coast. Hampton-Sydney at Washington and Lee. If that game goes Washington and Lee's way, they're in control of the ODAC and would have to finish it off in Week 11. But that would be a sort of a major upset, in the sense that midway through the season, Randolph-Macon was looking really good, Hampton-Sydney was looking good, and a lot of people that follow the ODAC were looking for that Week 11 game to be maybe unbeaten versus unbeaten, with playoffs and conference championship on the line, and that could still happen. It wouldn't be unbeaten because Randolph-Macon has one loss, but you know, if the results fall a different way this weekend, that game could still be a huge game. Hampton-Sydney, right now undefeated, top-ranked in the South Region regional rankings, and they can give that all away with a loss this weekend. And it's fun. It's weird when, you know, people talk about, you know, the Division I setup where they don't have playoffs, and they say, well, the regular season is the playoffs because you have to win every game. Pat, we've talked about in this podcast alone teams that have gone from being a lock to get in the playoffs undefeated to being in trouble now with just one loss. And then you got a team like Hampton-Sydney, which is sitting pretty right now, and they could be, you know, maybe not on the outside looking in, but they would drop into that Pool C playoff picture where everything is up in the air. if they don't handle business at Washington and Lee this weekend.
Well, Keith, actually, and to elaborate on Washington and Lee's playoff status, if they beat Hampton Sydney on Saturday, they're in. Their conference schedule is done. This is the last game that they have. They'd be 6-0, 7-2 overall, going into a non-conference game against Juniata. And that would be it. Washington and Lee would have the conference championship. So they could have gone on the list of teams that could clinch with a W, but there are so many other things that could happen in the ODAC as well, including it coming down to that that final game in week 11. We mentioned Mountain Union Baldwin Wallace. We mentioned briefly earlier in the podcast, of course, Whitewater is playing Wisconsin Oshkosh. Two big games that will help decide the Empire Eight, and you know where we would have thought we could have given it perhaps put it in pencil, if not pen, for Alfred after Alfred losing to University of Rochester last week. That's a non-conference game, but it still you know puts a little bit of doubt into people's minds. You got to remember Alfred is hosting Ithaca this week, and then Springfield at St. John Fisher. Those are the top four teams in the Empire Eight, all squaring off in the Centennial Conference. You know, we didn't really talk about this earlier, but Ursinus losing to Moravian on Saturday puts that league a little bit back in play. Ursinus plays Muhlenberg. Those are the two teams with one loss. And then the winner of that game cannot clinch the conference, I don't believe, either way. Johns Hopkins and Franklin and Marshall both tied right behind them with two conference losses. They face off, so one of them will drop out of that tie. And then, of course, in Pool B, you know, basically every game is a playoff game for a Pool B team. And we mentioned earlier, SUNY Maritime is playing at Gallaudet on Saturday. Wash U is at Case Western. Wesleyan Salisbury coming off their rivalry game this weekend. Both are on a bye week. Greenville is at Eureka if Pool B gets down that far, and University of Chicago playing Carnegie Mellon.
This playoff stuff, Pat, it's fun. I mean, it's interesting. The later we get in the season, you know, the more permutations there are, and you know, we get to a point where we're coming off a big Saturday, traveling, watching games, analyzing the whole national picture. You start to settle down Sunday when you put the top 25 vote in, you put your ballot together, and you know, we're just now recording the podcast later in the day on Sunday and figuring out what some of these different scenarios are, and that's the type of stuff that sometimes you don't figure it out until you really stop and think about it, or you talk yourself through it, and maybe that's later in the week where we have a better handle on every single conference race out there. And I know there's only 2 weeks left in the season, so there's only a limited number of variables in each conference race. But then you talk about the conferences like the Centennial, where four teams are alive, like the Empire Eight, where you have four teams that, you know, they seem like they're neck and neck. And I know, you know, Alfred is technically out in front right now, but coming off that loss to Rochester, you know, like you said, casts a little doubt on everything. You know, the potential three-way ties in Iowa, in the ODAC, New Jersey. You know, after that Montclair State-Cortland game, you know, who knows who's going to be the team that A, wins the conference, B, you know, maybe is a Pool C rep, and then there's going to be a third team that gets left out. And, you know, it's a possibility that three teams make it from one conference. It has happened once before from that Empire Eight. Three teams made it in 07, I believe, the first year,
yep,
where Mountain Union was the East host, and a couple of Empire Eight teams actually had to go and play Mountain Union and Alliance. I think Ithaca went out there early. I may be confusing my years. But in any case, it's fun at this point. I think this week is you know, one of the favorite times of the year. You know, it's always nice. The kickoff is good. The that time where there's 16 playoff games going on at once in that first week, where all 32 teams are in action, and you know, most of them right at the same time, that's a lot of fun. But these last couple weeks are as fun as anything when you get to a case where there's games Saturday. You know, you figured out the playoffs on Sunday. We have all our regular features in the first couple of days of the week, including these great videos that we're getting accustomed to see every Tuesday afternoon. And Wednesday we're going to have regional rankings again, and we'll be right back getting into the weekend, you know, anticipating all these conference matches sorting out.
And despite that, Keith, we brought the podcast in under an hour. That wraps up the Around the Nation podcast for the week of Monday, November 1st, 2010. don't forget to stay tuned for all of those things that Keith mentioned earlier as we get you ready for Week 10 coming up on Saturday.